As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there and welcome to the show. It's brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. Dan here from The Square Ball, along with Michael, and Phil Hayes here from The Athletic. And straight from Big Sam's press conference we've gone on Friday morning this time. We'll react to that in just a minute or two. First, the big announcement. Does somebody want to do a trumpet or a fanfare?
We don't have one, do we? If you told us, we'd have brought one.
I mean, could you not just do one with your mouth? That's all I was after.
There's nothing Michael can't do. And surely a Sam Allardyce impression can't be farther in the lane either.
So our big announcement is that the Phil Hayes Show is coming to an end at the end of the season. But only in its current guise, don't worry. It's moving over to the Square Ball because we've been externally producing the show for The Athletic for the last sort of 2.5 years, I think it is, we've been doing this now. The Athletic just moving away from that, from externally produced club shows. But the good news is they're happy for us to carry on doing the show. So big thumbs up. Great bunch of lads.
Great bunch of lads. And it means we can finally ask Phil his true opinions on all sorts of things. Hibs, for one.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to joining the stable. Do your legal partners do libel insurance?
I don't think they do they? Do they?
Maybe we've not needed it so far.
Let's not test that theory.
I've always played it very safe.
Yeah. So we will be continuing the show over on the Square Ball feed. So have a look at that if you're not yet subscribed. It'll move over to there in a few weeks. And because we're producing it for ourselves now, it means that we can put them all on YouTube so people get to see more of your face as well,
lucky
Phil. So
them.
All episodes on YouTube.
So I'll have to start shaving now.
A slim down, Phil, hey, it must be said, from this point last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it never takes me long to pad out again.
Shirtless by next season.
Summer's coming up.
So the final Phil Hayes Show will happen on this feed after the Spurs game. Then we will take a break, I think, we're thinking at least a week. I think everybody just needs a little bit of time to exhale and reset.
It's not as if there's going to be a quiet week after the end of the season, is there? But I think you might be right. I think everybody just needs to draw breath.
That was the thing I was about to segue straight into. I was going to say, we won't take long off because it's never quiet at Leeds United, is it? And no matter which way this season goes, it's going to be an eventful summer, you feel?
Yeah, it will be. There'll be plenty happening this summer more than most, I think. There is so much to be sorted out and so much to be arranged, not least head coach. And you would think we're just about into the final week of Sam Allardyce. He was asked today whether, you know, he was interested at all in the idea of sticking around and doing this for longer, but he didn't get into it at all. Not like he got into climate change and other things. It was, it was like listening to Greta Thunberg part today. We're just waiting for him to turn vegan now.
What did you make of the press conference overall then? Michael, I think you're coming round to the church of Big Sam now, aren't you, a little bit? It seems like refreshing that he's talking in very honest and forthright terms, whereas I think there's been a certain amount of, I don't know, controlling the narrative or trying not to say too much across the course of the season. I mean, take, for example, the comments on Jorginho Ruta, possibly worth mentioning those from the jump off here, where he's just basically said, yeah, look, he's for next year.
Absolutely thrown Victor Orta under a bus, hasn't he, essentially? But he's off in a couple of weeks or whatever. He's just gone, he's essentially said, yeah, he ain't ready. I don't know why he spent £35 million on him. Is what he could have said, but he didn't. But he was... It's what he meant, isn't it?
What were his quotes, Phil? It was to do with...
He was asked what he thought of Ruta, who obviously has played next to not at all since coming in from Hoffenheim for a lot of money, record-breaking fee, which is why he gets asked about so much. And he has been in the 21s recently. You and I were both at the game, the playoff final on Monday night, and he played and scored in that. And I thought he was okay in the game. Leeds played well. He's comfortably better than Nottingham Forest, but I wouldn't have said he stood out as being phenomenally above everybody else. But obviously those appearances kind of beg the question of any chance for a go in the first team. But Allardyce's reaction was to say, look, it's next season for him. And as Michael said, you know, did allude to the fact that he hasn't particularly looked ready for this. And, you know, coach after coach not playing him, including Allardyce, suggests to you that they don't really think he's ready either. I mean, Allardyce was asked, what's your impression been of him as a player? And he said, I haven't really seen much of him, which I think clearly he's training, and Allardyce sort of made it sound as if that was, I haven't seen him in many games, so what conclusions can I draw? But I think if in training he'd seen Ruta looking extremely impressive and very usable, then he would be minded to do that. But he was of the opinion that it will have to be a next season job with Ruta. I made the point, I think this is probably most telling from it all, that it's not just a matter of ability in this league. It isn't. It's about psychology, it's about physique, it's about the full package that lets you be a very good Premier League player. And I think you didn't have to work too hard to read between the lines, but reading between them today, I think what Allardyce was saying was he's not there yet.
What did you make of his performance in the 21s? My takeaway from it was that he's got buckets of natural ability, although it's not quite come together for him yet. Like, he got caught in possession a couple of times trying to do turns and things like that. So you could see what he was trying to do. Didn't quite manage to execute it, but there's clearly, you know, it's clearly levels above that level of football.
Yeah, I mean, Leeds were across the board against Forest. It was a real mismatch. And I don't know about you, but it felt from the early minutes like it was going to end up 3-0, 4-0, 5-0. It didn't seem as if Forest were in it to any great extent. And it makes you think and draws the conclusion that Leeds have recruited pretty well at under 21 level to compete in that league. You always find yourself asking the question, how many of these players are actually going to bounce from the 21s into the first team? Because that is what will pass judgment ultimately on the players that they've signed. So Sonny Perkins, Mateo Joseph, JB, for example, who the two of them are off to the under 20 World Cup now with England, look like good, talented prospects, absolutely. But if Leeds stay up, are they going to develop to Premier League standard? If Leeds go down, are they going to be good enough for the Championship? That's what you need to know. I think with Ruta, you can probably see slightly in his body language the impact of the fact that it hasn't worked so far for him at Leeds. And actually, it hasn't even remotely worked. He's hardly been involved and he's hardly figured.
It hasn't even started, has it?
No, it hasn't. And I'm like you. I can see raw ability there. I can see natural talent. Having watched what we watched of him at Hoffenheim before he signed, there was no doubt that he was doing very well in the Bundesliga and was looking like a worthwhile investment. Although whether or not he's going to prove to be a worthwhile investment at that level, we'll see over time. But I think the only conclusion you can draw from the under-21s game is that nothing in that performance made you think he has to start at West Ham. He is a player who's going to dig them out of this in the last couple of games. And it's not to say that he might not appear at some point and might not come up with something, but I think Allardyce is old enough and savvy enough to realise that he needs to nail his colours to different masts.
In terms of what Allardyce has said, just going back to one of his other comments in the last week or two, he's mentioned squad size as well, which flies in the face of what Victor Orta said about having a core 18 and then supplementing it with lads from the 21s. He's veered towards suggesting a 25-man squad would be more necessary.
Well, Allardyce has the advantage of being able to upset people and being able to say what he likes without much comeback. It's a four-game contract for him. You would assume that he will be off after next weekend, however it figures out. But I'll say this, he is saying it like it is, and not just when it comes to individual players like Ruter or recruitment or squad size or anything else, but also when it comes to the situation that they're in the league. Right from the start, really, it wasn't a case of him taking the job and then saying to us, look, four games to go, 12 points, so plenty of points to be had, big scope to stay up. He's pretty much said from the outset, this is going to be tight, it's going to be difficult. And he was clearly really disappointed with hindsight and having watched the game back to have drawn with Newcastle, because that was there to be won. And we wrote about Allardyce on Thursday, we were looking at what he's done so far, and the thing that really jumps out is the tiny number of completed passes that they've had in both games against City and Newcastle. Totally understandable against City, because you've seen in the past month them absolutely annihilate Arsenal and then Real Madrid. So really, what chance do you have, particularly at the Etihad? But again, against Newcastle, you know, those two games, lowest figures of completed passes at any stage this season. And it does make you realise that what he's doing, and he did say today he wants that to improve, but everything is predicated on fine margins, low risks. look for the odd chance here and there, because if you've not got much of the ball, you're not going to get many chances. And that, I think, explains why he was so annoyed about the missed penalty last weekend. Although he spoke well of Bamford and was very defensive of Bamford today, but also the penalties that were conceded. Because when you don't have a lot of chances yourself and you're not likely to score many goals, cheap concessions like that do come at a much higher cost. So, you know, we're saying if we beat Newcastle, to quote him, said 60, 65% chance of staying up. But it's quite honest in pointing out to the players that because they didn't beat Newcastle, they've got to go and beat West Ham. You know, no beating around the bush, really.
He specifically identified those moments, didn't he? The penalty miss and the penalty concessions, people not staying on their feet as he instructed them to.
Yeah, and also the handball from Firpo. I think those moments that make you feel like they're so avoidable, and if you do avoid them, then it makes it a completely different game. And Newcastle were kind of there to be beaten on Saturday. It did feel like that. I was tweeting halfway through the second half saying, it's really hard to know what to do here, because while a point against them feels good, you're going to have to win somewhere. And actually, this is set up in a way where it could be won. You know, if you just make the best of the last half hour and I guess play on Newcastle a little bit psychologically, because they were under pressure too, perhaps it was there to be done. And I think Allardyce felt that as well. And he's probably right to say that had it gone 2-0, that the penalty, Leeds would have taken 3 points from that, which would have made a huge difference. So, yeah, you know, fine margins, I think it is what he's going to rely on. But I do like the fact that he's just been very open and honest about where they are and saying to the players, look, this is it. You know, this is it. Potential for the table to swing in a way which leaves them no chance on by the end of Sunday's game. There's the potential for it to swing in a way where, and I think this is in the end what he's really looking for, where if they beat Tottenham on the last day of the season, nobody else can do anything about it and they'll definitely stay up.
It's been interesting to see how him coming in and the fact that he's here for a short time, how it's kind of sat with everybody, because he's talking quite frankly, isn't he? And saying things I think a lot of us have seen and said over the course of a season. You wonder how that would translate into, like, say if he was here for a full year and let's say we stay up and he was to stay in the job for a year and we're still not particularly good next season, whether those things would then go on to become grating.
Well, possibly. And the scenario changes from one where you have a head coach who can justifiably say, none of this is my fault. I didn't sign any of these players. I didn't set them up in the way they've been set up. I didn't coach them to do the things that they're doing. And that's impossible to argue with when his contract is for four games. Four games is a ludicrously short period of time to make any difference. But you get into next season, September, October, November, the incumbent coach, given that there will be changes over the summer and players will come in, players will go, squad will be altered, incumbent coach less and less has the scope to sit and say, this is down to somebody else. You know, they then start answering for what's going on and the team starts to be seen in their image. So it would be totally different. And I don't think much of what's gone on in this period has made me think that it would necessarily be a good idea to go any further with this before the end of the season. But whatever they do in the summer, they need to make a much better appointment, head coach-wise, than they have with the last two, definitely.
Just on the managerial appointment, presumably there are things going on behind the scenes around that for, I guess, options for Premier League and Championship. But who is actually doing that and under whose instructions? Because obviously we've got the ownership hanging over us. We've not got a director of football. So who's in charge?
Well, you still have Kinnear there as chief executive. Even though the ownership structure could change in the summer, you're not talking about different people coming into the boardroom, if that makes sense. Don't get me wrong, there would be additions to the board, there would be new directors appointed, but it would be 49ers Enterprises who were leading that, and they have been here since 2018. So you're right, it will be getting done in the background. They will be thinking very closely about head coaches, about directors of football, because they're going to have to get on with that rapidly. And the only people who can be on top of this will be the recruitment staff who are still there, but also your executives like Radrizzani, for example, Pragmarati, others, because who else can it be? Victor Arthur is gone. Sam Allardyce, you would think, will be gone in a week's time. I mean, one of the things that fascinated me was people have seen that Uruguay have appointed Bielsa at last, and that's been on the table for a long, long time. It's become quite clear that over the past fortnight, he became aware of the fact that it was being spoken about round here, that him coming back to Leeds if they were relegated might be a possibility. And while that's kind of, that seems like a sort of strange development and potentially a kind of unforeseen route to go down, because I don't think for a long time anybody would, at least of all him, would even have expected that that might have been suggested. It does make you realise that clearly people are starting to think about what they need to do and what needs to be done, depending on how this season finishes. And it's not even as if staying up cures everything, because if they stay up, they still don't have a head coach, they still don't have a director of football. Dan spoke a couple of weeks ago about the possibility that, you know, they switch from the director of football model to, say, having a head of recruitment and a head of football operations, which some clubs do, in which case there's two people that you need. There's a lot to be done, and that's before you even start on which players need to go, who needs to come in.
In terms of why Victor Orta wasn't sacked before, which was one of those, it was one of those clamours that you saw frequently on Twitter and forums and so on and so forth. Why is Orta still there? Why is Orta still in the job? Well, now you know the answer, because as Michael's just touched on, it creates a vacuum, doesn't it? If there's nobody there, you go, right, well, who's taking these decisions? Where, what happens now? Who's planning for the future?
Of course it does. And you have to ask as well, and this would again be something that if the 49ers Enterprises do take control in the summer, you'd like to know the answer to. How much of the forward planning that Orta has done, because he always did a lot, you know, he was always planning in advance, he was always thinking ahead for what might be next. How much of the planning that he's done will remain in place? How much of it will now just be completely disregarded? Because if you've got new staff coming in, new brooms tend to come with new ideas. It does create a vacuum in the way that sacking a head coach can create a vacuum as well. But sometimes it has to be done. I think the answer to why he was here for so long was because the 49ers did actually quite admire Orta, and I never got the impression that they were dead set on him going immediately, even had they taken over this summer. And clearly, for a long time, he'd been Radrizzani's man as well, very close to him. So I don't think it would be, you know, I don't think it'd be stretching it much to think that that was part of it. That was part of the reason why he was protected and why he wasn't removed in the periods where there was a lot of clamour for him to go. But what did it ultimately was that he thought Gracia could keep Leeds up. The board didn't believe that was going to happen. They wanted Allardyce, they wanted a change. And because they were on completely different pages, there was just no option but to go their separate ways.
Another of Victor Orta's final acts was Llorente's new contract. There are reports that Roma are now going to be sending him back at the end of the season.
Well, it hasn't gone particularly well for him at Roma, at least. It's not as if he's been a key player for them. There was an option in the deal for them to take him, which would have been in the region of the money that Leeds had paid to take him, to sign him in the first place when he came over from Spain. I was told initially that it was an obligation, but it sounded subsequently more like an option. And you're right, from what we're reading in Italy, it does sound as if he'll head back, and I can't say I'm particularly surprised about that.
Worth adding that he missed out on their European semi-final against Leverkusen due to an injury. But he is potentially in a European final before that one comes to an end.
But at the same time, he's a good example of how busy and hectic and hard this summer is going to be, because I don't know about you, I don't see where Llorente fits at Leeds at all. So there's a player that you need to move on, you need to find take a four, perhaps there'll be options out there for him, possibly back in the Liga or somewhere in Spain. But he's not the only one. You know, there'll have to be a fairly ruthless audit of what's gone on this season, what's worked in the dressing room, what hasn't. And it would be very difficult at the end of this season to tell yourself that a lot of what's in there has worked, or a lot of the players in there have played well. I mean, I'm in the process at the moment of doing Player of the Year piece, as in picking Player of the Year for a little blitz that we're doing on The Athletic next week. Almost certainly going to go with Rodrigo, I think, but it's been hard to decide and there are not a lot of options.
On our Player of the Year, we're veering towards Dan James at the minute, aren't we?
You were telling me earlier this week that he looks like he's going to top score.
Yeah. I think it's only Tyler Adams being injured and out of these final games that has kept Dan James off the top spot. So he's someone else who'll be coming back next year.
Well, Adams has had a better season than most, but a little like Robin Koch, it becomes difficult to decide whether he's actually had a good season because of the way it's gone, you know, and because of how it's been. And I'm minded to think that Leeds would have been worse off without Adams defensively, as opposed to saying with him in the team, they've not been a particularly good side either. I think the difference with Rodrigo is that he's been pretty prolific when you set the goals he scored against the chances he's had. And, you know, he's exceeded his XG. The goals have come from him. It's probably actually the first year where he's been able to demonstrate that he can do it in the Premier League. The irony of that being that he's had his best year in the season where Leeds have had their worst since promotion. So yeah, I think he's probably one of the last people who's going to draw criticism for what's gone on this year. But it's not as if there are people vying for the Player of the Year award, and never forget the fact that Leeds didn't actually award one last year.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Well, in about 9 days or so, we'll know exactly where this is heading, Phil, whether we're getting new owners or not. Which way do you think the wind's blowing on this? Do you think Radrizzani might go regardless of which division we're in? I'm getting an increasing sense that that's probably the way that this one's going to go.
Yeah,
maybe I don't know if that's fueled by the rumours about Sampdoria, or I don't know, just the sense that, you know, Orta's gone, and is Radrizzani minded to be the one to oversee the next cycle of this? Does he want his money, or is it time to cut and run? I don't know.
It will come down to money. Money will influence this in a big way, but there are different ways of doing it. He could stay on, obviously. He could retain 56%, stay as chairman and majority shareholder. The 49ers, probably much more easy process than going to full ownership, could move to majority position by taking a tranche of shares from him. And the impression I always get from the 49ers is that if Leeds stay up, they want to do the buyout. You know, they want to get that done this summer, want to take control, full ownership. I don't know whether there's any scope for Radrizzani to retain like a teeny tiny stake, but, you know, for the 49ers to have full control of the boardroom. But I do get the sense that if Leeds go down, they want to be running the club as well. And I think discussions are taking place to that effect. You know, how can this be done? What might happen?
We should just say there, Phil, that's because we mentioned on the show last week that the deal as it stands at the minute, there is a get-out clause, a cancellation clause, if Leeds go down. So you presume, you're hearing whispers that, what, they're back around the table?
Well, what they're going to have to do is come up with a separate deal that would allow them to take control in the Championship. But the one thing you have to remember is that that process couldn't afford to drag on for ages, because there's going to have to be some clarity pretty quickly about who's in charge this summer and how it's going to be structured. Because before you know it, the transfer window opens. And as we spoke about in part one, you need a head coach, you need a director of football, you need people taking these decisions unequivocally and fairly quickly in order to get on with everything. The link to Sampdoria is interesting because it's not a secret that Radrizzani in the past has spoken about investing in a different football club after Leeds. It's not a secret at all that he's looked at other clubs in Italy. There were links to Genoa. There is some talk that he's had a look at Inter Milan, although I don't know what the cost of Inter Milan would be. I would imagine pretty expensive. Sampdoria, not so much, you wouldn't have thought. So you would guess that if he gets the sort of deal that he's looking for from 49ers Enterprises, then perhaps that, you know, perhaps that could be done, and perhaps that's an option for him. It just feels to me difficult to see what's left for him here. And I know that if over the summer they put together a squad that actually turns out to be really competitive in the Championship and can get out of the Championship, get promoted automatically or promoted via the playoffs, then some of that dies down for sure. But at the same time, these 2 years have been incredibly difficult, and there's not a lot of goodwill out there. It doesn't feel like there is, and there'll be even less if Leeds go down.
I love dropping the word optics in, because Succession is coming to a climax on...
Yeah, I've not been watching any of it, actually. Is it any good?
Very good. It is exceptional. Yes, it is very, very good. Optics. Jed York and the 49ers brass meeting the Sheffield United owners, being photographed in Saudi Arabia with them. And then stories then emerge about a Silicon Valley-funded takeover of Sheffield United. And it's not hard to join the dots there. I mean, I'm not suggesting for a second that it is them, but you can join the dots very easily and think, well, that doesn't look great, does it? Have you got anything on that?
No. But what you can say and what you can see is that the money coming into the Premier League is getting bigger and bigger and is coming from that sort of direction. And anybody who's buying in is going to need huge amounts of cash to make a go of a club like Leeds, even more if you're going to try and make a go of a club further up the tree, which is why, you know, the bid from Qatar for Man United has been touted as £5.5 billion. That's how it's going now. I mean, it's, people know, or we've spoken about the kind of structure of 49ers Enterprises, which is the fact that people like Moratti, Colin Meader with him, will be the face of it. But behind it, it will be individual investors. And it's not that the individual investors will influence the day-to-day running of the club. You know, that will be down to 49ers Enterprises. They will oversee the project. But in no way is the money coming from the San Francisco 49ers. They're involved, obviously. But as a whole, it's a much bigger group.
Could it be then that they're meeting about other business interests? Maybe it's different investors for a different deal? Because they do have a lot of fingers in a lot of pies, don't they?
Yeah, I have no idea. I really don't know. But they do. That's the thing. It's an investment vehicle that has not been set up in any way just for Leeds United. You know, it's an investment vehicle that does throw money at other things and does pursue venture capital interests and has been on the go for quite a while. If it goes ahead as planned, I don't see it deviating much from the model that we understand it to be and the people that we understand to be involved. But I've said a few times, this is kind of the stuff that you want to sit down and be able to ask them now. And I know that isn't going to happen until a takeover's done and until we have a clearer picture of what's going on. But there is a heck of a lot to get into with them. I mean, as a basic starting point, I think I'd be interested to know what they really make of the last two seasons, what they think has gone wrong specifically, what their part has been in it and what they're going to do differently to make sure that things improve.
The other side to this is that they couldn't own Sheffield United and they couldn't own Leeds United at the same time. So they're in for 44%. So it seems unlikely to me, just based on logic alone, that they're going to be getting involved in that. It should be something entirely separate.
There's no indication at all from them that they want to exit from Leeds. But obviously, I guess at some point you would assume that this has to tip over to majority ownership. Otherwise, as I've said before, what is the point?
Yeah.
You know, like that must be the end game for them. And you would like to think that in these circumstances, if they stay up, obviously they have the scope to buy out Leeds, no problem. And the money seems to be there as well. If they go down, you would like to think that they would be able to sell to Radrizzani an idea or a proposal that works for everybody, works for them, to be able to say to him, look, you know, you've been here since 2017. You've had 6 years as either outright owner or majority shareholder. Perhaps it's time. And I think it definitely is time. You know, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But I'm not naive enough to ignore the fact that if they went down and had parachute payments and sold certain players, pulled transfer fees in, that it would be possible for Radrizzani to put together a squad that could compete strongly for promotion. And obviously in the Premier League, Leeds are worth more money than they are in the EFL.
I find pretty much every aspect of takeover talk thoroughly depressing.
And quite boring.
Well, it's just the feeling that no one actually really wants us. No one wants us for us, if you know what I mean. Radrizzani essentially doesn't want to leave because I think he's got nothing else to do and he wants his money out. The 49ers only want us if they think they can make money from us.
And football gives you a platform, let's not forget, as well. It gives you an exposure.
Yeah.
Relative to the size of the industry, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you look at other takeover stuff and it's just, you know, $5.5 billion from Qatar for this, the Saudi money for this. And you just think, God, what a horrible business it all is, really.
Years ago, Jonathan Liu did a piece in The Guardian, which was kind of typically punchy in the way that his stuff is. He does some great pieces. And he said, you know, the point of the piece was, your owner at your club, whoever your owner is, whichever club you support, does not care about you and does not care about your club. That might be pushing it a little bit too far, but I think the point he was trying to make was that very few of these people are invested in the club beyond money. You know, that's the thing that is money and exposure. So you could say ego or just, you know, I guess the public persona it gives you, that's the attractive nature of it, no? And given that Manchester United have now reached the point where its bids coming in from Qatar, that's where it's at, that's where it's gone. There's not going to be a reverse gear from that point. And as clubs get more valuable, the people who buy them are going to have hideous amounts of money. And who in the world has hideous amounts of money? Not local business people, not generally club supporters, with very, very rare exceptions. I mean, even Jim Radcliffe at Manchester United always laugh about the piece I read about him having a season ticket at Chelsea. You know, like, it's just a money man. You know, that's what it is.
And we're still in the position where football clubs, as a rule, don't make money anyway, but yet are worth a fortune.
Well, oddly enough, football clubs probably could make money if they wanted to make money. But I think, again, the more wealthy your owners, the more wealthy the regimes who take over your clubs, the less they need to care about that, you know, because they can lose a fortune and it makes no difference. You know, Abramovich used to spend a fortune at Chelsea. Didn't seem to bother him in the slightest. No, nobody ever seemed to say to him, you know, what about the money? You know, what about, you know, if Dan was to buy, I don't know, I'm trying, if you were to go home with a Ferrari.
Yeah.
And say to you,
and there's a Ferrari garage just next door.
Yeah, which I've seen you wandering around, actually. I think, that I invest in?
Just seeing what I can steal.
And say to your wife, so we're 90 grand down. She wouldn't just go, all right, oh, that's nice. That's good. And I look at Chelsea's squad, the players, the really fascinating thing with Chelsea this summer will be who gets moved on, given the money that's been spent on them and potentially very recently as well. It just doesn't seem to be a problem. And I think that's what makes football lose its marbles slightly more and more as well, is that it didn't actually seem to be a right lot of jeopardy in it for a lot of these people because they are so rich.
My hope for summer is that no one buys anyone off Chelsea. Everyone sits tight. When they're desperately touting around Conor Gallagher for £3 million, people going, nah, we'll wait for until you go bust.
There was that great line in a piece that we did on Chelsea saying that the players having to sit in the corridors to get changed because there wasn't enough room. It was like the piece I did on Romanoff at Hearts. Somebody was telling me, I think it was Stephen Presley, the old captain there, was saying they had to extend the benches into the shower rooms because they had so many players. They couldn't all get sat down when they were getting changed. But I think it's sometimes ownership and takeovers, it's all a bit dry and it's all a bit anti-football, if you know what I mean. It's anti the passion, emotion of football. But I suppose the thing that you have to remember with the 49ers, with 49ers Enterprises, is that a core part of what they want to do is the redevelopment of Elland Road. And that is so badly needed. You know, that really is so badly needed. It's also an incredibly expensive job. So that alone, I think, is something to look forward to if it does happen.
It's interesting, isn't it, thinking about Marcelo Bielsa. We mentioned him there in part one, taking the Uruguay job. And we had a little chat around this, you and I, Phil, on WhatsApp yesterday, that concluded with the point, like, I think I said to you, we'll never see the likes of him again. What a bloke. And you just said, well, it's great to have had it though. And that's how I feel about it. Like, mm-hmm. Bielsa transcended all that stuff that we've just been talking about, all the finance and stuff, none of it mattered. Because there was a quote, and this is how our conversation started around it, from his Uruguay press conference. And now, I don't know if this is directly attributable to him, whether the translation's right or what, but I just loved it. And I sent it to you, because obviously you're a journalist. Football is for the people and the players. Then there are those in between, coaches, directors, journalists. I think these last three are the worst in football.
Scum.
We must try to avoid destroying football. And you said back to me, I blame the people and the players. which made me laugh.
He's right though, isn't he?
But what I described it as a love affair, and what a love affair it was. And anybody who doesn't understand why we love Marcelo Bielsa, that is it in its essence, isn't it? That he transcended all that. The corporate stuff, the money stuff.
We will have to say that did also win a load of games.
Yeah.
That was very important.
And that's the thing.
Yeah, we played great football.
Yeah, when you match up the idealism with what you actually saw on the field, which was, beautiful football, loads of games won for such a long time. It's hard not to fall in love with that just as an idea. It taps into everything that you used to do as a kid when you kicked around with your mates in the field.
Yeah, so journalists and executives, no argument about that. I think he's been self-deprecating by including coaches in there because he is probably the best example of what a coach can do to a team and what a coach can give to supporters and to City, like Leeds as well. And, you know, Guardiola falls into that category also. There's no way you can look at Guardiola and say he's kind of damaging football. You know, he's like Manchester City are a totally different discussion. But tactically, what he does, it changes the game. And I think it...
Bold
it
fraud, changes, Phil. A bold
changes
fraud.
It for the better. Me or you.
All three of us.
But it is the case, I think, that with somebody like Bielsa, you're lucky to have had it. I mean, he's a fascinating guy to write about always. Like, we've done a piece this week on how the deal was done for him to go to Uruguay, but also a piece on past international jobs that he's had. So I was tasked with speaking to somebody about Chile. So I got in touch with a guy called Harold Main Nichols, who was the head of the FA in Chile and the guy who appointed Bielsa back in 2007. Said to him, you know, like to speak to you about this, that and the other. More than happy to do it. And straight away, as soon as you get into the stories, it's like there it all is again. So Bielsa sent him, they told him there's no money for the training centre in Chile in Santiago. You know, there's no way of upgrading this. So even though you would like it to be the best of the best or whatever else, we don't really have the cash. Bielsa says, that's fine. But in that case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do lectures and seminars across the country in Chile. And if people pay for them, all the money we get from it won't come to me. I'll spend it on the training centre. So Harold Mainico says, yeah, absolutely fine. But then Bielsa says to him, the only thing is, you need to set up a separate bank account for it because it's not going to the Chile FA. You know, it's got to go to this one bank account so that, I don't think he said this, but so that basically nobody can spend it on jollies and frivolities. You know, it's got to be there so that if I want new facilities, something changed, construction work done, I know how much money there is and we can spend it. So they did that and they set that up and they made some pretty significant improvements to that training centre because he did, the Contamine Nichols. I mean, Chile FA had no involvement in setting any of it up or anything like that. You know, they just left him to get on with it. But he said he did about 100 over 3 years, you know, and raised money from all this. But the best story by miles was Mayne Nichols getting a phone call about 7 o'clock in the morning as he was driving his kids to school. And Bielsa said to him, I need to speak to you, I need to see you. I said, well, okay, well, you know, I'll come and see you at the training ground. When are you going to be there? Well, I'll be there in an hour, just dropping the kids off, you know, won't be long. And Mayne Nichols said that the day before, you'd sometimes get in Santiago, 24 hours of rain. And what happens at the end of it is that the next day it's crystal clear and everything, you know, all the clouds fade away. And you're left with this beautiful view of the Andes, the mountains. So he got to the training ground and he said, back in those days, you'd always have to, as like the head of the Chile FA, you always had to be in a suit, tie, smart shoes. But he also says to him, shall we go for a walk? Yeah, why not? So he takes him and they start walking around the pitch and he says, this pitch has been rained on for 24 hours. So Bielsa's in his tennis gear, but I'm in this smart suit and shoes are just getting absolutely caked in mud. And we get to the final corner of the pitch and he says to me, do you mind if I live at the training ground? Mayne Nichols says to him, no, it's totally up to you, but it's not like we need to save money. You know, we can put you up in the city. There's nothing around here. So there's no like cinemas, no shopping centre, whatever else. And Bielsa said to him, yeah, but the thing is, I couldn't live myself if every morning I wasn't able to have a view of those mountains every time I get up and get out of my room. So he did. He lived at the training ground for 3 years. And Mayne Nichols said the room was tiny. There was nothing in it. It was a tiny closet. There was a bed. It was like room for a small TV. And more to the point that from 6 o'clock onwards, after, you know, everybody cleared out, you had a little bit like Thorpe Arch. You had this kind of 20,000 square meter complex that was pitch black and there's nobody there. You know, and he just day after day after day, that's where he was and that's what he did. And I think beyond anything else, just built a fantastic team that they loved in Chile and they still love. And I think he was saying to me that the first game, Bielsa's first official game outside of friendlies, I think is against Chile-Uruguay, which would be quite an occasion. So let's go on square ball expenses once I switch over to your feed.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
To the London Stadium at the weekend, Phil, the penultimate game, the penultimate fixture of the season, and one that's going to shape a lot of what happens over the next 12 months, you feel?
Yes. I was just thinking there, we never really got into Bamford, did we? Who, incidentally, I thought it sounded like Allardyce will 100% play at West Ham. Or into why I called him Greta Thunberg earlier. But he was having a dig at the abuse that had been aimed at Bamford and also the kind of threats that had either been made or the threats that Bamford had been feeling. And Allardyce was just talking about how social media was taking over the world and it was a bit of a malign influence. And then got on to talking about AI and the impact that's having on jobs and climate change and everything else, which something of a unexpected turn at 9 o'clock on Friday morning. But he was, and I think has been this week, very supportive of Bamford. And I totally expect him to be in the starting lineup. I was just saying, you know, that these are the circumstances where you have what all you can do in response to this is to try and score goals that matter on the day and make a point that way. But the really intriguing thing with this is going to be, what difference has West Ham's European game last night made to this, to how they're feeling, how much they've got in their legs, to how well they play on Sunday, to how much it matters to them.
Have they got
Sunday.
Much in their fists as well after the old fisticuffs?
It was a bit tasty, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think those West Ham players should have a worldwide ban from football
for the week.
just to cool off. They shouldn't be getting involved in that stuff.
There was part of me thinking, well, let's hope the Dutch authorities act swiftly and decisively and detain them for at least 72 hours.
Yeah. And Moyes placed the under-14s, yeah. he made a lot of changes after the first leg, Moyes, against Brentford. They were really poor there, lost 2-0. And I think he used the phrase goosed afterwards. He was not trying to pretend that they'd been remotely in that game. They're basically safe, aren't they? They're not going to go, you wouldn't have thought. So he has the potential to switch things up. He's going to have to. There'll be certain players whose legs he has to rest. I would assume that he will start Declan Rice, because this does start to feel like it's going to be Rice's last game at home for West Ham. It's not as if the European final is looming on Tuesday. They can afford to draw breath a little bit now. But I asked Allardyce whether or not it was a bit simplistic to look at these two games and say, you know, West Ham have Europe to think about. Tottenham just seem to have checked out a little bit from this season. Does that make it a bigger opportunity? And his answer was to say, basically, look, forget about Tottenham. If we don't go and play well at West Ham, it's probably not going to matter. And he's very clear in saying that they need to win at West Ham. I think he's right.
And that's a bloke who obviously he knows the game as well, doesn't he? He's got experience of that. I guess that after the Lord Mayor's parade type feeling that can sometimes, you know, not in a way that's going to kind of dominate everything, but if you lose that sort of 5%, maybe 10%, it can be enough to let the other team win, can't it? Especially the Premier League, which is dictated by such fine margins. If they're just not quite at the races, or it's just not quite as exciting, or there's a sense that it's not as important, or they've got one eye on the final, whatever it might be.
Even take out the fact that they've progressed and they've got the final coming up. Allardyce mentioned the fact that the Thursday to Sunday switch over from Europe back to domestic football is really tough. Yeah, it's really hard mentally, it's really hard physically, however the games have gone and whatever the results have been, it is really demanding.
Essentially, they'll only get one day of prep, won't they?
Yeah, well, you would assume that unless they've flown back late last night, they'll be coming back this morning. Most of it will be recovery, regeneration sessions to get themselves ready for the weekend. Obviously, he will shake the team up, so there'll be some fresh players coming in. It's not as if it's going to be the same 11 that was playing AZ Alkmaar. But I guess the straw clutcher in you likes to think that it's going to have an influence on the game on Sunday. And I saw a feel with both of these games. And he said this, you know, he said, we need to get stuck into West Ham early. We need to get stuck into them straight away to see if there is a bit of a hangover. And I think the hope is that with these games, if Leeds play in a really intense style, it's going to ask of Spurs and West Ham whether they really fancy 90 minutes of that. And you hope the answer's no.
Yeah, with one eye on Declan Rice potentially leaving, then Phil, you hope that maybe that takes over as well. That's their narrative for the day. There's a bit of a distraction.
Yeah. Allardyce did say towards the end, we were talking about Rice saying he hoped David Moyes might give them an extra night in Amsterdam after the result last night.
I hope he has done.
Well, that's what Allardyce said. But then he said, you know, maybe it would help. You know, maybe a few beers and a bit of relaxation at this stage of the season, maybe they'll play better. I think there probably is part of Allardyce that suspects that if they go at West Ham hard, they might actually find that West Ham really do feel the pace from this week. But at the same time, again, going back to his experience of the game, he was trying to say at certain points, you shouldn't just presume that that's going to be the case. You know, you shouldn't just assume that West Ham are not going to bother because they're in the European final and what does it matter? They still have good players. They still have good players. And I think their season has been affected by their schedule, without a doubt. But they always felt like they would be good enough to stay up, and they have been.
Yeah, you get the sense that Big Sam's the sort of coach who would say to the dressing room, you've got to go out there and earn it, lads.
Yeah, it's what he was saying today. It's what he's been saying right from the start. You know, that no point sitting talking about we need this and we need that. You've got to actually do it. And again, to go back to the Newcastle game, I think he was really pissed off about the penalties because it was just an easy way back into the game for Newcastle in what otherwise would have been really difficult circumstances for them. And, you know, they had a really big win over Brighton last night. So they are almost there for the Champions League. But you could see, I thought it 2-0, you could see the pressure that was on them because they were absolutely playing for a winning goal. They wanted to win that game at Elland Road because they kind of knew that they probably needed to, or that it might be good for them if they did. And Allardyce is right. You know, if Leeds do win that, they're on 33 points rather than 31 and they're in 17th rather than 18th, and it totally changes the dynamic.
And the incentive for Newcastle Monday night, while we continue to clutch at straws, is beat Leicester and you guarantee Champions League football. So let's have some of that, please.
Yeah, and Eddie Howe will be saying that. He did say after the Leeds game, two home games to come. That's big for us. That's where it's going to be done, if it is going to be done. So yes, that would help.
Left back, no Junior Firpo.
Yeah.
Blessing or curse?
Well, on the basis of the second half against Newcastle, quite a blessing, I would have said.
But hints of a change of formation, maybe?
Yeah, and I think that's probably owing to the fact that there isn't really a natural alternative, is there?
Sign a left
back. You could play... Yeah, let's get that going again. Here we go. For the eighth summer running. He could play strike there. He could move Verba there, although I just don't think he particularly want to do that.
Both of whom have given away penalties.
Yes.
Very recently.
Jack Harrison, I've always thought, probably has the physique to be able to do that job if you want to. But Allardyce talking about them considering a change of formation made you wonder if that might be the way he goes, if he maybe does three at the back instead.
What about Jack Harrison, left-hand side of a three?
Why not? Millie in the middle, tallest player in the squad. Yeah, it might well be that he goes down that route, plays with wing-backs.
Yep. I found interesting the fact that, you know, he's deployed Robin Cock in midfield. Do you think we'll see that again?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised at all, yeah.
That he's done that, and he's very quickly... And I know Rocker's injured, but quickly identified areas that need to be addressed in terms of maybe upping the aggression and physicality and stuff like that. Things that people, it feels like we've been seeing all season, really.
It's percentage play, isn't it? So, you know, we started today talking about Ruter. And part of the reason that you won't see Ruter involved much, if at all, I think, is, as Allardyce says, very raw and needs to develop, but just not a safe bet in any regard when you desperately need points and you've got two games to go. It's just not somebody who you're going to lean on to any great extent. Maybe Odron is a substitute in one or both of the games, but I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't get any more minutes between now and the end of the season either. Cock in midfield, definitely designed to tighten things up, keep it as compact as you like. I mean, in the piece that we wrote yesterday, we were looking at the passing networks, and at the risk of being unkind, they're almost non-existent. You know, there's very little link-up between individual players, not much in the way of patterns of passing either. As I say, that you cannot be critical of that at the Etihad because that's how it goes, but Newcastle aren't as dominant in quite the same way. But when he was asked about that today, Allardyce did say, we need to be a bit less frantic, we need to be a bit safer on the ball, we need to
where do you think that might have come from?
Where do I think what might have come from?
Being frantic on the ball and careless in position.
Yeah.
Which is mad because the first thing I thought of when you said that, then I thought that your point you were going to make was, what is this, the 100-70 that Jesse Marsh was talking about? So we're frantic on the ball, yet we've got to slow down.
I think what he was meaning was that they're trying so hard to make it happen and trying so hard to get something out of these games that they possibly need to take a little bit of a step back mentally and just be a bit calmer on the ball.
Do you think that's what Robles was getting at when he calmed the Kop down?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, because the Kop, and for anybody who didn't see this, it was in the first half against Newcastle, and there was a kind of surge from the crowd. It wasn't just from the Kop, it was from the ground generally, but a surge for him to launch the ball after he caught it and get a quick counter-attack going. And I think I'm right in saying that it had gone 1-1 at that point. I think that's right. But even if it hadn't, Newcastle were kind of coming into the game. It was starting to feel, it was starting to feel like hard work for Leeds. And it's quite unusual to see that, of him just turning around and rather than just saying to the players, you know, cool it down, saying that to the supporters behind him. And, you know, I think that's probably what Allardyce wanted from him, as opposed to Melier, was the kind of older head who's able to stand there and say, even though I've got 36,000 people saying, launch the ball, I'm, you know, cool enough to say no.
You identified there something that Big Sam spoke about, which was ball retention and better use of it. I was surprised, like my preconceived ideas of the Allardyce style was to, you know, you get it, you boot it long, no risks. And that did happen against Newcastle. As you said, Phil, the passing network's basically non-existent so far. But there were moments, there were some moments in that Newcastle game where we did some really nice link-up play.
Yeah.
Good football on the ground, passing in triangles, that sort of exciting stuff. So well, it's not beyond their wit and wisdom, is it?
The opening goal being an example, the penalty that Firpo won being an example as well. I mean, that itself, that process, the concession of the penalty for the foul on Firpo, almost underlines what Allardyce is looking for. Looking at Greenwood, he had all... Well, I'll ask you the question. How many completed passes do you think
two.
Greenwood had?
Yeah, he did. I've read the article.
Oh, well done. Excellent. Yeah. Still subscribing. Two passes completed in the whole of those 45 minutes. But one of them was enough to send Firpo in for a penalty. And I think, again, that isn't that what Allardyce is getting at? You know, we're not going to have many moments like that. We're not going to score many goals. We're not going to be laying it on so thick that it's going 4-0, 5-0, 6-0. So in those circumstances, you cannot be handling the ball when it's like a yard above your head, and you can't be diving in the way that Verba did. I suspect a few players have had a bit of a bollocking this week, would be my reading of it.
Something that perhaps that was lacking from the Grassier era. These are the things that we never see. We don't know, do we, what exactly goes on behind closed doors, what the energy's like, what the dynamic's like at the training ground.
The peculiar thing is, people have been asking me more and more, you know, if Allardyce had come in after Marsh, would Leeds have stayed up? And you can't deny that the results under Grassier were very good initially, and much steadier, and that everything seemed to suddenly look orderly where it hadn't before. I wonder, though, if it would be fair to say that with Allardyce, there would have been less chance, had it started well or started similarly to Grassier, less chance of it falling away and collapsing in the way that it did, which still kind of baffles me, how bad it got and how quickly. You would like to think that Allardyce would have been better at holding it together, although, you know, Grassier did have track record of having kept Watford up a few years earlier, so it's all hypothetical and you'll never know for sure. But the one takeaway you can have at the end of this is that asking somebody to rescue you in four games is no strategy at all. And if it works, it works. But you can't pretend that it was some kind of light bulb moment which got you out of it.
It's the ultimate Hail Mary, isn't it? I mean, go on then, let's do what we do best on here, which is set you up to be chucked under the bus, Phil. How do you feel like this game on Sunday is going to go? What's your general vibe on it?
I think they're going to win.
He said it now, hasn't he?
Does that mean we're staying up then?
Well, that depends on what goes on elsewhere. I mean, quite honestly, I have no idea what's going to happen the next week. No. Really, really no idea at all. But I can see an argument for them winning both games because of the teams they're up against and the position those teams are in. Once you start thinking about it, you it gets complex in your head about what might happen. And there is that side of me that says, well, even if Spurs are not necessarily pulling a leg to any great extent, they do still have players in the team who will score against teams who are not great defensively. And although Allardyce is working on that, Leeds as a whole this season have been less than not great defensively. And West Ham have good players as well. So I really think both games are incredibly difficult to call, but I still feel like they're very much in it, put it that way.
I feel like the circumstances couldn't be any better for this game. Whether or not that is enough for us to win, yeah, I don't know.
That's a really good way of putting it. Well done, Michael.
Yeah, and similarly with Spurs as well, who are, you know, the maths will basically preclude them from the Champions League, if not already. Yeah, they can't do it, can they, now? So they can't get that. I don't think they can even do...
No, they can't even finish fifth.
They can't finish fifth,
They're not in the running for that. I mean, the variable in this as well, of course, is what goes on in other games elsewhere, and that does, you know, Allardyce said himself, you know, it will be a different situation if we suddenly feel like we actually have to win, otherwise we might be done, as opposed to we need to win because we need points on the board. That there is a difference, and there are circumstances in which Leeds could be pretty much on the brink by close of play on Sunday. So it's going to be one of those weekends.
Spurs are interesting. I'm just looking at their goal difference. It's only plus six. They've conceded 59 goals, which is by a streak the highest in the top half of the division, and only I think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teams have conceded more. Obviously, we're one of them, but that's a defence you can penetrate.
Well, you know the thing that gets said about performances catching up with you? There was that long period where Tottenham under Conte didn't seem to be very good and seemed to be winging it quite a lot, but somehow always seemed to be top four, and you're never quite sure how it was that they were sticking around there, but the points just kind of kept coming, except inevitably, because of how they were playing and because it wasn't that great, that dried up, and they are in seventh. At best, they're going to finish sixth. Brighton seem to be slowing up slightly. But yeah, there's nothing left for them at all, and I don't think there'll be anything left for them when they come to Elland Road.
Well, all we have left now is blind hope, isn't it? I was saying on our show this week, I've gone beyond the I've had enough, get it all in the bin. This all needs to end. I've swung back over into excitement now. I'm kind of excited to see how this one goes. And I don't know if that makes me sick or what, but that's where I am. Maybe it's just because I know it's coming to an end in 9 days and we can finally all just deal with a bit of certainty and exhale and go, all right, fine. It didn't go the way we wanted, or it did go the way we wanted. Good. It's over.
Football's got a horrible way of keeping you in it till the last minute, though, hasn't it? I mean, if the Sheffield Wednesday game last night is a perfect example of it.
Good God.
Everyone went into that going, well, it's over. Whatever. And then you score in the opening minutes and you go,
hang on a minute.
I just don't know it. If we get the next one. And then the Peterborough fans are pulled back in and then, oh, God, the whole thing's too much.
Did you find that really stressful?
I was going to watch it. My son's ill at the moment. He's got tonsillitis. So I was watching it on my phone until extra time when I got it on. And even watching the extra time, I felt kind of sick, even though I had absolutely no dog in the fight. Couldn't really care less who goes up out of those two. I can see the fun of both Darren Ferguson and Sheffield Wednesday fans being unhappy with it. But yeah, just the twists and turns in it. And also getting to the end of it and thinking, if that was Leeds, I wouldn't be thinking, oh, our name's on it now. Now we've been through all this turmoil. I'd be thinking, well, bloody lose at Wembley.
Make sure we just got it over with.
It's the way of extracting maximum disappointment from the season. Is 96 points, not go up. Playoffs, go through all of that to then still not do it.
Says a lot about the way you think.
do you remember the 3-3 draw with Norwich that Leeds had with Monk? It was the day when it was kind of totally do or die for the playoffs, and they went 3-0 down in the first half. And you'd probably never seen a team who looked like the wheels had come off more. And you thought, oh, it's this, you know, that's it. We'll just put our feet up for the rest of the game. And then it finished 3-3, and there was that late chance for Roof, I think, that he almost scored for 4-3. And you're right, it just dangles you all the time. I think I have probably now made peace with the fact that this is just football, isn't it? This is just how it is. And somebody has to get it every season. Yeah, I cannot work out at all how the next week or so is going to go. But I don't know about you, I feel like if Leeds can get themselves out of the bottom three this weekend, then I think they're in a position to do it. I don't mean they're in a position statistically to do it. I think there'd be a pretty good chance of Allardyce getting it done on the last day. But let's see.
Dear God, please. Please. That's all we ask.
And then we can do it all again next season.
Roll on August, everybody. Right. We will wrap it up there then. You can sign up to The Athletic, theathletic.com/Leeds pod. Heading down to the London Stadium, Phil, as always.
I am. I'm going Sunday morning. Hopefully the trains are all right. I'll see you on there if you're going from York.
Yep. Enjoy. And we'll do our best to enjoy the game back here as well in Leeds. And if you're off to the London Stadium, cheer us on. We'll speak to you on Monday on the Phil Hay Monday Club. That's over on the Square Ball feed, where you'll find this show actually moving across in another few weeks' time. We'll speak to you soon.
The Phil Hay Show.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.